is an internal medicine doctor and since 1998 has been the team lead for epidemiology research in the Division of STD Prevention at the National Center for HIV, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention. Since 2004, she has coordinated the HPV Vaccination Working Group of the ACIP. Her talk is on human papillomavirus vaccine update. Okay, good morning. Since the last immunization conference, we don't have any new recommendations for HPV vaccines. So what I'm going to do today, but there are a lot of data, new data and other new information. So what I'd like to do today is give a broad overview covering a variety of topics. I'll give a brief overview of the vaccines, give a very brief summary of some issues around status of implementation, and then talk about HPV vaccine for males and some of the data relevant to that discussion, and then talk about new and ongoing research. So just briefly, I think everyone knows there's two vaccines licensed in the U.S., the quadrivalent vaccine, which is directed against four types, 2, 16, and 18, which are oncogenic, and 2, 6, and 11, which are non-oncogenic. And the bivalent vaccine, which is directed against two types, 16 and 18, and both vaccines are given in a three-dose schedule. Recommendations for HPV vaccine in the U.S. have been evolving. In 2006, the quadrivalent vaccine was licensed for use in females and recommended for routine immunization at ages 11 and 12 with catch-up. And then in October 2009, the bivalent vaccine was licensed for use in females, and ACIP revised recommendations to state that either vaccine could be used for routine vaccination and catch-up. And then also in October 2009, the quadrivalent vaccine was licensed for use in males, and ACIP stated that the vaccine may be given to males 9 through 26 years, but this was not included in the routine immunization schedule. And just a brief summary, which I think some of you have seen before as well. This is our understanding of the current vaccines for females. Both vaccines provide very high protection against 16-18-related precancers, and the quadrivalent vaccine also provides high protection against 6 and 11-related condyloma or genital warts. There seems to be some cross-protection against precancer lesions due to high-risk types other than 16 and 18, and the data are somewhat stronger for this for the bivalent than the quadrivalent vaccine. Both vaccines produce high seroconversion rates, and the geometric mean titers after vaccination are higher after the bivalent than the quadrivalent, but both vaccines produce titers that are substantially higher than after natural infection, so the significance of this finding is unclear. And local reactogenicity is higher after the bivalent than the quadrivalent, but both vaccines are well tolerated. Now, as a follow-on to the discussion on duration of protection for meninge, I do want to mention that there's no evidence of waning protection for after HPV vaccination. This is important, of course, because you're vaccinated years before some people before exposure, and you want people to be protected throughout their sexually active life. To date, the studies provide data for the quadrivalent through 5 years, showing excellent duration of protection, and studies for the bivalent are through 8.5 years, and there's ongoing post-licensure studies that will provide additional data. Now, both vaccines have shown very good safety profiles pre-licensure, but studies, of course, have shown that vaccine safety is of concern among parents, and also there's been a variety of media attention around this. And I want to review really the substantial amount of post-licensure monitoring data that's available, mainly for the quadrivalent vaccine, because this vaccine has been licensed for longer in the U.S. First of all, we have VAERS data, and the first 2.5 years of experience were published in 2009, and before each ACIP meeting, these data are updated and posted on the web. We also have data from the Vaccine Safety Data Link. These were presented to ACIP in October of 2010 and also at this conference, and I'll review those briefly. And there's also a Vaccine Pregnancy Registry, which is a 5-year regulatory commitment by Merck. And interim data was published at the end of 2009, and that study is also ongoing. And then the manufacturer has a variety of other post-licensure commitments, including at least 7 studies that are planned or ongoing, and these were reviewed in a recent publication listed on the slide. And the FDA reviewed all of these data at a review for the FDA Pediatric Advisory Committee in December of 2010. The VSD active surveillance study evaluated over 600,000 vaccine doses, and the study confirmed no significant increased risk for any of the pre-specified endpoints that are listed on the slide. There was no increase in anaphylaxis compared to previous studies, and based on no cases of Guillain-Barré observed in this study, an attributable risk of greater than 4.4 per million doses was able to be ruled out. And the VSD is going to continue monitoring some of the endpoints, and we'll be also looking at bivalent vaccine and also quadrivalent vaccine in males. Now, we heard a little bit about how we're doing in vaccine implementation, and I know there's been a lot of talk about this during the conference, so I'm just going to review this very briefly. HPV, as we know, has more challenges than other adolescent vaccines. It's a three-dose series. It's a sexually transmitted infection, and there's been considerable controversy around school immunization requirements. Vaccine initiation, as shown here, has increased, according to the National Immunization Survey, from 25% in 2007 to 44% in 2009, but coverage with three doses of vaccine is still only 27%. And again, this is a variation of the slide that was shown earlier in this session. Although initiation is 44% overall, there's a wide variation across the country, ranging from the low 20% to in the high 60%. And all the reasons for these differences are not really known, but they're being investigated, and these can include differences in infrastructure by state, funding, as well as other factors such as legislation. And these are some other selected findings from the National Immunization Survey. As we all know, receipt of a provider recommendation is a very important factor for initiation of any vaccine and was found for HPV. Race and ethnicity was not associated with initiation, but Black and Hispanic adolescents were less likely to complete the vaccine series compared to whites, and I know this has been discussed also earlier in the conference. And adolescents with public insurance and those who receive vaccines in public settings were less likely to complete the vaccination series. So we have a lot more work to do regarding getting vaccine initiation and completion up in the private sector as well as the public sector, and particularly to prevent disparities in vaccine coverage that will exacerbate some disparities in disease that we see in this country. Now I'd like to turn to talk about some policy issues around HPV vaccine for males. And as I mentioned earlier, in October 2009, FDA licensed the quadrivalent vaccine for males 9 to 26 years for prevention of genital warts. And ACIP stated at that time that vaccine may be given to males, but it was not included in the routine immunization schedule. It was included, though, in the Vaccines for Children's program. And then in December 2010, FDA included an indication for prevention of anal cancer for quadrivalent vaccine, and the ACIP has been revisiting this issue of HPV vaccine for males. As for all vaccines, issues that are considered in making recommendations include vaccine efficacy, epidemiology and burden of disease, programmatic issues, acceptability, and cost effectiveness, and all these were considered for the male vaccination question. In October 2009, when male vaccination was first considered, issues that were discussed when making the permissive recommendation included that there were programmatic challenges at the state and local level. Most of the burden of disease is in females. Priority should be given to vaccinating females to reduce the overall burden of disease and cancers. And the outstanding issues for future consideration were efficacy for prevention of the anal intraepithelial neoplasia endpoints, which were being studied at that time, cost effectiveness, and vaccine price. Now, since October 2009, ACIP has continued to review data related to HPV vaccine use in males, both in October 2010 and in the most recent ACIP meeting, and we've reviewed a variety of topics listed on this slide, and I'm going to review some of the data for you now. These are the data from the efficacy trial that were available in 2009 at the time of first licensure. These were the first data on efficacy in males, and in the per-protocol population, efficacy was 89% for prevention of vaccine-type genital warts. And these are the data that were are currently unpublished, but were submitted to FDA and led to an indication for prevention of anal cancer in both males and females in December of last year. There was 75% efficacy for prevention of vaccine-type anal intraepithelial neoplasia, which is a precancer lesion. This was a small study conducted in men who have sex with men who have high rates of anal cancer and anal precancer lesions. Now, in order to understand some of the issues around male vaccination, I want to review data related to overall burden of HPV-related disease in the U.S. And while oncogenic types were first associated with cervical cancer, they've now been implicated in a variety of other less common cancers, and these include vaginal, vulvar, anal, penile, and oropharyngeal cancers, which are a subset of head and neck cancers. And this slide summarizes the percent of cancers due to any HPV and HPV 16 and 18 from a variety of studies that have been done in the U.S. And as you can see, while essentially all cervical cancers are due to HPV, a variable percent of cancers at the other sites are due to HPV, ranging from 36% for penile cancer to 93% for anal cancer. And as with cervical cancer, HPV 16 and 18 are found in the majority of HPV-associated cancers. These percents have increased from our previous estimates as data have become available from new studies. And the site for which there's been the most new data is the oropharyngeal site, and that percent has increased most markedly from past estimates. And this slide shows updated data of burden of HPV-associated cancers from 2004 to 2007, which are the most recent years available. This combines data from cancer registries as well as data that I just showed you looking at the percent of cancers at different sites due to HPV and HPV 16 and 18, so we can get estimates of that burden. And you can see in the last column, which shows HPV 16 and 18 associated cancers, that there are approximately 22,000 cancers occurring in the U.S. every year, about 14,700 in females and about 7,000 in males. The most common cancer HPV associated in females is cervix, and the most common in males is the oropharyngeal. Now, this doesn't really reflect the overall burden of cervical disease in the U.S. because we have a cervical cancer screening program in this country, which is very expensive. And without that program, there'd be a lot more cervical cancer because these cases are detected before they become invasive and are treated. And I wanted to show you this slide, which may give a better sense of the burden of these different cancers. This shows the estimated annual cost of HPV-associated disease in the U.S., and you can see the vast majority of this cost is actually due to cervical cancer screening, which is being used to detect cancers before they develop. And the other amounts are listed here as well. You can see cervical, other anogenital cancers, oropharyngeal, anogenital warts, and recurrent respiratory papillomatosis, which all contribute to the financial cost of HPV-associated disease in the U.S. Since the quadrivalent vaccine was just given an indication for anal cancer, I want to review briefly some epidemiology of this cancer. The incidence is increasing in the U.S., and between 1999 and 2004, the incidence increased about 2%, between 2 and 3% per year, and which a lot of people don't know, the incidence is actually higher in females than in males. Men who have sex with men have a higher risk of anal cancer than heterosexual males. And although data are not available from cancer registries, the estimates are as high as 37 per 100,000. And HIV-infected MSM have a higher risk of anal cancer than MSM without HIV infection. And data have been examined in the era of highly active antiretroviral therapy. And during that time, the incidence of anal cancer has not decreased in HIV-infected persons, and in some studies has shown an increase. The other issue that ACIP has been looking at is acceptability of HPV vaccine for males, and there's a variety of studies looking at providers, patients, and parents. This is a study looking at provider acceptability. It was a national survey conducted in the summer of 2010 after the permissive recommendation was made, and this found high acceptability among providers, although it was lower than acceptability for female vaccination. The current practices for females are on the bottom two bars, and the intention to recommend routinely to males if there was a routine recommendation are on the top two bars. And red is strongly recommending, and orange is recommending, but not strongly. And you can see that 87% of providers would strongly recommend to 11 or 12 year old females, and 75% they would strongly or recommend to males in that age group. 94% would strongly or recommend to 13 to 15 year old females, and 87% to similarly aged males. Cost-effectiveness issues have also been looked at for male vaccination, and I've just listed some key points here. First of all, and most importantly, cost-effectiveness of male vaccination depends on vaccine coverage of females, and the most favorable scenario is when coverage in females is low. And this is because high female coverage leaves little room for benefit of decreased HPV transmission from vaccinated males to unvaccinated females, and males would be indirectly protected through female vaccination. And because of the current low coverage in the U.S., models show that at our coverage levels, male vaccination appears to be cost-effective. And if the vaccine price were lower, the cost it would be more likely that male vaccination would be cost-effective even at higher coverage levels. Because of the high burden of HPV disease in MSM, models have also looked at the cost-effectiveness of vaccinating this group, and also this group would not benefit indirectly from female vaccination. And vaccination of MSM does appear cost-effective in the one model that looked at this at a cost per quality of less than $50,000. This was over a wide range of assumptions about age of vaccination and prior exposure. Now, just to finish, I want to mention that there's a lot of ongoing research and monitoring activities going around about HPV. There's phase 4 studies going on, impact monitoring. There's a study looking at HPV vaccine in HIV-infected persons. In the past year, there were two studies looking at immunogenicity and safety in HIV-infected individuals, and there's about 10 ongoing studies in HIV-infected individuals. There's studies looking at variations in spacing of the doses and number of doses. Two studies published in the last 2 years have looked at longer intervals between the second and third dose, between the first and the third dose, giving the third dose 12 months after the first dose. And there's also studies going on looking at 2 versus 3 doses. There's an immunogenicity study from Canada, an efficacy study in India and Costa Rica. There's also second-generation HPV vaccines that are already being developed. There's an L1-VLP vaccine, which is the same type of vaccine that we, as the two vaccines licensed in the U.S., with additional oncogenic HPV types included. There's L1 capsimers, which is a lower-cost system for development. There's L2 vaccines, which uses a different protein on the surface of the HPV virus, which can induce antibodies against a broad range of HPV types, not just the types in the vaccine, and there are many others as well. So in summary, HPV vaccine introduced in 2006, and we have two vaccines that are available, and either is recommended for females. Coverage is increasing. But it's low, and efforts are needed to increase uptake and to address a variety of barriers, which I know have been discussed throughout this conference. HPV-associated disease includes a variety of cancers as well as disease due to non-oncogenic HPV, but the largest burden is from cervical cancer and precancer. Policy issues for HPV vaccine in males are currently being reconsidered, and there's really a substantial amount of research and post-licensure evaluations that will inform future policy decisions. I want to thank a variety of people who have helped with the HPV work group and with the other data that I've presented today. Thank you.